And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. How was your weekend?
Good. How was yours?
Very good.
Good baseball,
good,
I know.
Yes. Well, today we focus on the plasma bone marrow cancer affliction of multiple myeloma. It's often difficult to diagnose and has varying treatments. Joining us now is Dr. James Berenson, the founder and CEO of the Institute for Myeloma and Bone Cancer Research. He's an expert on myeloma and other blood-related cancers, and he joins us from Beverly Hills, California. Welcome to you, Doctor.
Good morning or afternoon, depending on where you are.
Well, here it's afternoon.
Yes. Well, good morning to you, Dr. Berenson, and thanks for taking the time for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
I'd like you to begin with just the basic etiology of multiple myeloma and bone cancer. What are the causes and the origins?
Multiple myeloma is a bone marrow-based cancer of terminally or late differentiated B cells. These are the cells that make antibody. So this is a cancer of antibody-producing cells. There are about 25,000 Americans who are afflicted with this newly each year, and there are probably about 200,000 Americans walking around with this disease as the patients live longer and longer. The causes of myeloma are largely not well worked out, but we do know that this disease is much more common in African Americans than white Americans and less common in Asians. We also know that patients who have had exposure to pesticides, especially farm workers, are at higher risk to develop myeloma. And recent data suggests overweight individuals also are at higher risk of developing myeloma. There is also a slight male predominance. Men have this disease about 60 to 40 compared to women.
I had read that first responders to the 9/11 attacks were found to have up to a 40% higher rate of prostate cancer, thyroid cancer, cancer, and multiple myeloma. Has multiple myeloma been linked to other things other than the pesticides, other environmental causes?
Well, there's been some data with radiation exposure. Long-term survivors of Nagasaki and Hiroshima have a higher risk of developing myeloma. We do see a plethora, a lot of patients who come from electrical engineering and the aerospace industry, although that's really anecdotal in our own practice. I do think there's something there. There's a signal, but it has not been well worked out yet.
What are the beginning symptoms, and how do they progress?
Patients generally present, if they have symptoms, with back pain. They can have an infection with fever. They can have kidney failure with associated inability to urinate, and also have nausea and vomiting and just feel tired. That tiredness may also be from anemia or the fact that the cancer itself produces a number of proteins that just make you feel tired. Many patients, however, present with no symptoms. They just have an elevated total protein. They're making too much antibody. Since this is a cancer of antibody-producing cells, when there are many, many cells in the bone marrow, they make lots and lots of antibody, and that's reflected either in a high protein level in the blood or protein that suddenly appears in the urine. Normally, you have very little in the urine.
So in other words, it severely reduces the immune system.
That's very interesting because we've come on to something that we think may explain that. So you're right. In fact, what happens in myeloma is the bone marrow is overridden with these single-producing antibody cells called, again, plasma cells, and they don't make any other antibody. So they solely make one antibody, and hence, with that, they're at very high risk for other infections. As well, they can have low blood counts, either from the marrow, which has been overridden by the plasma cells. There's not room for other healthy marrow cells, and they can have low white counts, or sometimes from our treatment, which can lower white cells as well and make them susceptible to infections.
Why is it that I've heard of cases where the patient didn't know until they were in kidney failure that they had myeloma? Is it that difficult to diagnose, or is that an anomaly?
Well, it is pretty hard for the general practitioners to diagnose. Most patients come in really late. They probably had the disease for several years, And many times they present with just that, kidney failure, because there really aren't a lot of specific symptoms early on in kidney failure. You may feel a little weak or tired, but it isn't until late that you really have the severe problems with the nausea, the vomiting, and just can't get around to do anything. That's pretty late. But it's pretty tricky because sometimes patients don't have an elevated protein at all in the blood. It's only in the urine, and patients can't really measure their urine protein, obviously, and that's not done routinely when patients go to see their doctors.
So is anything being done to correct that so that it can be diagnosed more readily?
Well, I think it's just more awareness. I mean, we're trying to push that patients have more of these things called serum protein electrophoresis and urine protein electrophoresis so you can find it. In fact, it's interesting that many, many more Americans harbor a premalignant form of myeloma called MGUS, for monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance, which is a mouthful. It's MGUS, and all that says is there's an abnormal antibody, but it's a marker that you have a risk to develop myeloma. You won't necessarily do that. And we now know that pretty much everybody with myeloma starts out with its premalignant form, but probably less than 5 or 10% of people are identified who have that in the United States, even before they get myeloma.
So myeloma isn't likely to be diagnosed in one's routine yearly blood work?
No, that's correct, unless your protein's high. And many internists, family practitioners miss that. They just don't really pursue it further until it's very high, until the patient's anemic, their kidneys are shot, or they have bone problems. They really don't usually pick it up. They kind of just slough the total protein off. And I think if we paid more attention to it, you're right, we'd find it early.
So should you mention that to your physician, that you want to be checked for myeloma?
Well, I would say at least, you could do that, but I would say at least you should get a look at your total protein and also just see if there's protein in your urine.
Is there an age range during which myeloma is generally diagnosed? I just heard this morning one of our coworkers was telling us about somebody who was in their 20s that was just diagnosed. Is it becoming more common to get this? Two questions I have.
Well, in answer to the first question, the average age of myeloma is about 65 in the United States, and it's generally true throughout the world. I've seen patients as young as 18, though, and we certainly are diagnosing more of it. There's been a lot of argument whether that's from environmental reasons or for example, people are living longer. Maybe we're finding it because we're making physicians more aware that they should be looking for it. But certainly the numbers are going up in this cancer in quite a significant way over the last 10 to 20 years.
And so do you think, what's your own personal opinion of why that is?
Well, I think my opinion about that is severalfold. One is we're all living longer. It's a disease of the elderly, for sure. Two is there's more awareness of it. And three is I do think there are going to be environmental and other factors that are going to be identified that are leading to some of this. Those studies are very difficult to do, having done a couple of myself. But I do think there's something there that we're doing that's causing some of this.
Now, the disease is incurable, but treatable. What's the average prognosis for someone who has this as far as life expectancy?
Well, things have changed dramatically since 2000 with the development of multiple new drugs and targets, so that back before 2000, the average survival was about 25 to 30 months. Recent data we're updating will suggest it's well over 10 years on the average, and we have many patients out 20 and 30 years now with myeloma. That was really unheard of pre-2000.
How and why did you get involved in this mission to cure these terminal illnesses, Dr. Berenson?
Well, it dates back to the early 80s when my wife was pregnant with my nearly 28-year-old. And during that time, she developed hand problems. And my cousin was a very prominent orthopedic surgeon right next to Beverly Hills. She went to see him, and during this time while I was studying sequencing antibodies as part of my fellowship research at Caltech in L.A., my cousin, hugged his kid in the swimming pool, broke his ribs, and lo and behold, this orthopedics had myeloma. And I thought, oh, I'm going to work on this. He was a great guy. And now, coincidentally, I take care of the person who used to put casts on for him now 25, 30 years later. It's a very small world.
You mean who also has it?
She actually has pre-myeloma. Thank God she only has MGUS at this point.
We're speaking with Dr. James Berenson. He's the CEO and medical and scientific director of the Institute for Myeloma and Bone Cancer Research, and president and CEO of Ongo Therapeutics, which we're going to talk about, which conducts clinical trials throughout the United States related to myeloma and metastatic bone disease. We're going to come back after a short break and take your calls and your emails. Stay with us. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Dr. James Berenson. He's the CEO and founder of the Institute for Myeloma and Bone Cancer Research. That website, by the way, is imbcr.org.
And we'll have links for that on our Facebook page and website.
If you'd like to join in the conversation, if you have a question or a comment, the number is 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-9576. Or you can email radio at WLRN.org. Radio at WLRN.org.
And we have a caller here. This is Glenn. He's in Hollywood. Thanks for your patience. Hi.
Hi there. Yes, I'm calling because my girlfriend is 45 years old. Both of her parents died of multiple myeloma. Her father was in his middle 50s. He was Chinese. And her mother was, I believe, in her early 60s, and she was Latin. And I'm wondering if she's at increased risk for it. Is there a genetic component? What she can do about that. Also, you were just talking about testing protein. Isn't there a urine, like a dipstick kind of test? Can you buy that over the counter? Should she check that?
Your question's most fascinating from several aspects. One is the husband and wife relationship, because we have multiple couples in which a husband and wife both have myeloma. In fact, I have several couples from Oregon who come and see me, both of whom had myeloma. And I think this is very interesting in terms of a potential infectious risk for this disorder, which I think there might be something there. And there is certainly data suggesting that family members do have a higher risk. The risk, however, is only about 2 to 3-fold higher, not 10, 20-fold higher. And myeloma, of course, is a much less common cancer than, say, breast, colon, or lung cancer. But there is a higher risk. Now, in this situation, I certainly would suggest that she have some screening done. It's very inexpensive. She could have a serum protein electrophoresis, which is a simple blood test in which the proteins are separated based on their size and whether they're positively or negatively charged. In addition, she could have the same thing done on a spot of urine. The urine dipstick for protein is not a very accurate test. I wouldn't suggest she have that done, but she could have a very inexpensive screening test done. I would suggest that she might want to go ahead and do that. But again, I want to reassure you that myeloma being an uncommon disease, her risk, although higher, is not that high, given the risk, say, in an average woman from getting breast cancer, colon, lung cancer, they're much higher than myeloma, even with a family risk.
Okay. When you say infection, what's the nature of the infection? How is it transmitted?
Well, we're not really sure about that. We need to do a lot of more work on it, so I can't tell you. We think there may be some specific infections that may be culprits, but there needs to be a lot more work on this. And I wouldn't certainly be worried about you getting it from her or that sort of thing. This is pretty unclear at this point. And I always say it's like what we call a Venn diagram. You have to have the right genetics, the environmental risk, and you also probably may have to have the right infectious exposure. But all that coming together is not a common event. As I said, only about 25,000 Americans are diagnosed each year. So obviously it's pretty rare given that there's 300 million Americans.
Okay, Glenn, well, best of luck to you.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
We have an emailer, Mary, wants to know, how elevated would blood protein be and or how much change year to year might be a warning? Would the urine protein be high enough to cause a touch of foam in it, and would that also be a warning?
That's pretty insightful. Yeah, usually foamy urine is protein in the urine in our patients. You can sometimes know whether they're better or worse depending on whether foam in their urine is worse or better. In addition, the elevation of the protein in the blood, if it, you know, you generally proteins in the blood, your total protein runs about 7-ish, 7-8 in that range, and about two-thirds of it or about half of it is albumin. That's your healthy protein. The remainder of it is in the globulin fraction, and that's where your antibodies sit. So when that globulin fraction goes up, especially we get worried. I would say, you know, if we're a gram or so above normal, you got to be concerned if it's above normal. In the urine, if you start seeing elevations in the urine protein that are more than several hundred milligrams or tenths of a gram a day, that's significant. And then you probably need a protein electrophoresis, which will again tell you and identify whether there's an abnormal myeloma type protein there.
Is that test, would you, is there an abbreviation for that so people can?
Yeah, there is. In fact, for the serum test, it's called SPEP, or SP for Paul, E for electrophoresis, P for Paul. So it's serum protein electrophoresis, or SPEP. And in the urine, it's UPEP, urine protein electrophoresis.
Okay.
In the case of multiple myeloma, are bone marrow transplants common?
Well, they certainly are commonplace. I was a big fan of having those done up until we had all the new drugs. I do not recommend those anymore, but I'm in the minority internationally. But, I mean, there is certainly now many more people moving in our or my direction as we see more and more success with all of the new drugs, and especially combining these drugs more effectively and safely. So I believe, as I like to say, myeloma is a marathon. It's better to run the race with 10-minute miles, which I hope to do at the LA Marathon in March, and finish the race rather than run 4-minute miles and drop out at mile 5. So fortunately, this is a chronic disease now with all the options, and we want people to have their best quality and quantity of life both, not just quantity of life.
Again, we're speaking about multiple myeloma with Dr. James Berenson, and our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. Dr. Berenson, I want to talk about your organization. You have the Institute for Myeloma and Bone Cancer Research, but you also have the Oncotherapeutics, as well as your clinical practice. Could you tell us how they work together, and what do you do? How do you do these clinical trials at the Oncotherapeutics?
Sure, absolutely. So about 10 years ago, with the help of one of the gentlemen who's about to get on the phone who's got myeloma, Ron, we formed a nonprofit Institute for Myeloma and Bone Cancer Research to perform preclinical, that is before the clinic, studies in the test tube and animal models in which human myeloma grows, to test drugs, to do biology, to find new targets that can help our patients with myeloma and related diseases. In addition, we have a second entity, which is called Oncotherapeutics, which is a clinical trials group that works with hundreds of oncologists across the country on trials to make myeloma patients better, testing new drugs and new drug combinations for these patients. And last but not least, we see patients, 25 to 30 myeloma patients every day, and we treat them. Many of these patients are on the trials that are being performed through Oncotherapeutics. Now, the advantage of this organization is the rapidity in which we can do these things, which is much, much faster than when I was at UCLA, or would be similarly true at other universities. And the other advantage is that I can take advantage of things that I'm doing in the clinic, and then if I find something that works, go back to the lab, prove it works, also optimize it, and then perform clinical trials not only on my own patients but through Oncotherapeutics with the hundreds of other oncologists from Miami to New York and Seattle to San Diego.
How and why does myeloma affect the bones the way it does with the lesions and the fractures? And is that because it's affecting the bone marrow?
That's a great question. So why do patients with myeloma have bone loss? Well, it turns out it's because the myeloma cells elaborate substances, proteins, that actually turn off the formation of bones and stimulate the Pac-Man cells. These are called osteoclasts to gobble up bone. So as a result of that, there is too much bone loss and not enough bone formation, and therefore your bones are brittle. Certain areas that are heavily damaged have holes in the bones and are especially at high risk to fracture. Patients also can experience bone pain either from the fracture or the expansion of the bone marrow into the bone, which then compress on the outside where the nerves cause the bone pain. So patients commonly with myeloma will present with bone, especially back pain. Many of them have fractures in the spine.
Let's take another call. We've got Milton. He's in Boca Raton. Hi there.
Hi. This is Milton from Boca Raton.
Could you turn your radio down, please?
Yeah, I'm going to shut it. Thank you. This is Milton from Boca Raton, Florida. I have been diagnosed with amyloidosis AL, and I'd like to know, and I'm being treated for it, and I'd like to know what is the likelihood, if any, of this developing into multiple myeloma. I know the two diseases are closely related to each other. I'll take my answer off the radio. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Milton.
All right, well, good luck.
Thank you. I was in Boca Raton lecturing a couple of months ago on myeloma, actually, but not on amyloid, but I do see a lot of amyloid. Amyloid is a disorder in which that abnormal antibody protein breaks down in such a matter as it can damage the kidneys, it can damage the lungs, and when it damages the heart, it's pretty significant. It also can damage the nerves. These patients today, in my experience, live a very long time, as long as they don't have heart involvement. The treatment for amyloid is quite similar to myeloma, and whether one has amyloid without myeloma or with myeloma, it really doesn't change very much what we do in our clinic. In about 5% of myeloma patients, or maybe 10, have amyloid. Most patients do not go from amyloid to myeloma, but the myeloma patients can develop amyloid over time. Many of them may have had amyloid at the beginning. We just missed the diagnosis. You have to find that funny-looking protein in the bone marrow or kidney most often, sometimes in the fat pad or in the abdomen in a biopsy done there. But those patients generally, if they present with amyloid, don't develop myeloma. But really the treatment, the prognosis, quite similar to myeloma. The good news, again, with all the new treatments, patients with amyloid are living long and fruitful lives today.
How is multiple myeloma the same or different from other blood cancers? Like, we more commonly hear about lymphoma and leukemia. Are there any similarities?
Well, there are similarities in that they're cancers of the blood and bone marrow, both of those types, lymphoma and chronic leukemia, are similar types of cells, B lymphocytes. The difference is myeloma is a later vintage, if you will. It's the latest terminally differentiated stage of the B cell, the plasma cell again. And it's much more commonly associated with bone disease, which you don't commonly see with lymphoma or the chronic leukemias. However, that being said, many of the drugs that work in chronic lymphocytic leukemia and lymphoma work in myeloma. It's not always true. There are a number of antibodies that have proved very useful in lymphoma and CLL, or chronic lymphocytic leukemia, that don't work so well in myeloma. On the other hand, there are drugs such as Velcade, bortezomib, that work very well in myeloma and don't work so well in most lymphomas, although they do in some. So, you know, the treatments are somewhat similar but not exactly the same. Prognosis varies so much in these lymphomas, depending on the type, how aggressive it is. It's really varies all over the place with lymphoma because there are so many different types of lymphoma.
We're speaking with Dr. James Berenson. He's the medical and scientific director of the Institute for Myeloma and Bone Cancer Research and president and CEO of Onco Therapeutics. conducting clinical trials throughout the United States. Another break, and we'll come back. We'll speak with a patient, and we'll take more of your calls. Stay with us. And welcome back to Monday's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, we're visiting with Dr. James Berenson of the Institute for Myeloma and Bone Cancer Research, that's imbcr.org. And we are talking about multiple myeloma. Dr. Berenson, so how do your patients fare nationwide in terms of their survival rate?
Well, clearly the survival rate that we published a couple of years ago was far, far longer than national averages or even at the major institution. We are now updating that data currently, and the preliminary data looks, as I said, well in excess of a dozen years. And I think that we really try to do very focused and personalized care. We certainly use drugs that are approved, but we use them in ways that are quite creative and to match the individual patient's medical condition, myeloma condition, and actually their lifestyle condition that you're going to hear about from a patient shortly. So we believe that we are able to, in fact, have patients with not only longer quality, but excellent quality of life as well.
We're waiting for, let's see.
Is he Mr. there? Ron Rogers.
Ron Rogers. We're actually waiting for him. But until we get him, did you want to take
we have him here.
We have him. Okay. Ron, are you there?
Ron Rogers.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey there.
Ron, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. Ron Rogers is joining us now. You're a patient of Dr. Berenson, and you've been you've had multiple myeloma for 15 years. Tell us a little about you and tell
15
us.
15 years.
15 wow. years, yes. Tell us a little about yourself.
Well, let me go back a little bit to the beginning when I was first diagnosed by another doctor who told me that I had about 2 or 3 years to live and that I immediately needed a bone marrow transplant. And I went online and to find someone for a second opinion. I found Dr. Berenson, and I'm still around at 15 years, and I'm going to be on a horse in a little while as soon as we get off the phone.
You're going to be on a horse?
Well, that sounds good. So the quality of your life is what it always was before you were diagnosed. Is that what you're saying?
No, not quite. You know, it's been a minor inconvenience, but that's about it. I still ski, I still ride horses, I am still extremely active in business. So, you know, I've really had a great quality of life in the last 15 years.
What is your age, Ron?
Excuse me?
What is your age, if we can ask?
I'm just turned 70.
So you were diagnosed when you were 55?
Yes.
And how long have you, Dr. Berenson, how long has Ron been your patient?
Ron's been my patient since the very beginning, way back in the late spring of 1998.
And how severe was his case?
Well, Ron's case is really instructive because when he first came to me, as he stated, he was told he needed a bone marrow transplant. And here's how great research is. He went on a drug at the time that had not been approved called zoledronic acid or Zometa that's used throughout the world that I was very involved in the development of that and the FDA approval process for it. And Ron, lo and behold, on that drug alone had an 8-year remission with no other anti-myeloma therapy and has led to a lot of interest and why these drugs, which were formerly thought to be just bone builders, kind of like drugs like Boniva, Fosamax, which many, many older folks take for osteoporosis, that these more potent agents like the Zometa can actually improve not only the quality, but extend quantity by killing myeloma, and that's what it did for Ron. He didn't need anything for years.
And so it was kind of off-label that you found that it worked for myeloma, and it was actually
the drug at that point, Bonnie, in the late 90s, was not even approved. It was in early development studies. So Ron was in a clinical trial.
Yeah.
Hmm. Well, that's pretty amazing. And do you have a lot of patients that are just on Zometa?
We have some. I mean, I can't tell you it's commonplace that the drug alone will lead to the kind of great remission we saw with Ron, but it has led to clinical trials to evaluate that. And recently, the English have done a large study actually proving that you could actually use this drug, in that case, in conjunction with other anti-myeloma drugs. And if patients got that, rather than a very weak drug in that class, they actually live longer.
I'm still on Zometa every month.
We have an emailer which kind of addresses this. Marianne says her friend was diagnosed with multiple myeloma and AL. She's seeing an oncologist here in Weston. She's confident she's receiving the most current treatments from Cleveland Clinic, but some friends and family believe she should seek out a second opinion or try to get into clinical trials elsewhere. She's concerned that any lapse in treatment would not serve her health well. What's your opinion about seeking second opinions, delaying treatments, and or leaving here in order to seek treatment elsewhere, like in California?
Well, I'm a big believer in seeking second opinions. I'm also a big believer in not getting scared into doing things you don't feel comfortable with. That in most cases, not all, but most cases of myeloma, philosophy should be don't just do something, sit there and just wait and check it out before you feel comfortable to move ahead with the therapy recommended for you. There's not one way to do this, and anybody who's very adamant that it has to be done this way in a myeloma patient, we just don't have that data today. There are a lot of different approaches that can be taken and effectively. Now, there are a minority, maybe 15 or 20% of our patients, who do need immediate treatment. Those patients who come in with kidney failure, you don't want that protein messing up the kidney any longer than you have to, so you want to intervene quickly. If patients have extremely low blood counts and their marrow is filled with those weeds, those plasma cells, you got to get rid of the weeds, I like to say, and get the green grass to grow quickly. And if there are a lot of those ugly-looking plasma cells, the malignant culprits in the blood, you got to get rid of those because that's a very bad sign. So in those cases, you got to move rapidly. But that's a minority of patients that present with myeloma. And in fact, many patients today, including several in my clinic this morning, receive no treatment except perhaps Zometa. That's it for years.
Ron Rogers, the drug regimen that you're on for myeloma, I'm sure it's not inexpensive. What does it run you?
Most of it's paid
through
insurance.
Mm-hmm.
But if I hadn't gotten a second opinion, I probably would not be around.
Yeah, well, you were given 2 years to live, so
you're
probably right. Well, I guess in answer to Marianne's question, I guess it depends on the case.
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody should get a second opinion, and if they see me, they should go get a second opinion, too, as the first opinion. It's as I like to say, if I bring my car in, I don't know an alternator from a carburetor, and it's like a patient coming to see me. I mean, they come in, they're totally have no idea what this is about, and there's a lot of different approaches, and some people feel comfortable with me, and some people feel comfortable with other doctors. That's okay.
But I would certainly not take a recommendation from the first doctor you see to go see a friend of his or someone that he may be affiliated with. I think you should find a doctor that has no connection whatsoever with the one you're currently seeing.
Okay.
And there's the voice of experience.
Yes.
I agree with Ron on that one for sure.
Okay, Ron. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck to you, and good health to you, and enjoy your horseback ride.
Yeah, stay on that horse.
Okay.
Thanks, Ron.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's take another caller. We've got Janice.
Thank you so much for joining.
We have Janice in Fort Lauderdale. Janice, you're up.
Okay. Hello, Ron.
Ron's not with us anymore, but you do have Dr. Berenson.
Oh, Dr. Berenson, okay.
Good afternoon.
Hi, did you want to ask the doctor something, Janice?
Yes, I would. I'm a 54-year-old African-American diagnosed with multiple myeloma, 80% of the body this year, this past April. And my protein count, it started to go down rapidly, but now it's very, very slow. Is there something I can do to bring the protein down quicker, or is there is it a diet or that sort of thing?
We don't know of any diet per se that can help. Some of my
Janice,
patients...
excuse me, Janice, can you turn down your radio, please?
Okay.
We don't know any of any diet per se. Some patients have tried a diet from Germany from the 40s and 50s called the Budwig diet, which is a interesting diet to say the least. I can't tell you whether that works for sure or not. There seems to be a couple of anecdotes that maybe it's helped some, but in general.
The Budwig diet. She asked what
Budwig,
it was.
The Budwig diet. I'm not going to highly recommend it or not recommend it. I can't tell you for sure it works, but some people have tried that. But in general, we just say to stay away from preserved foods and, you know, diet sodas with aspartame. But, you know, we don't even have any data on that as well and how that may make the myeloma worse or better. In terms of driving the protein down, my belief, if it's come down and it's now stable, that's okay. It doesn't have to go completely away, this abnormal protein. Remember, we're measuring a surrogate in myeloma, this protein marker. We don't actually measure the myeloma itself. We can't do that. It's in the bone marrow. So we use the surrogate marker. But, you know, I don't think it necessarily has to go to zero for you to be, you know, staying around for a million years. Look at Ron, my friend, you know.
Right,
his protein marker's been
the
there for 15 years.
The doctor said it keeps going down, but now it's going down just slow, just little points each time, but I thank God for that.
Well, that's fine. I mean, you know, if it's gone down and then it's going to stabilize, you'll probably end up being on some form of a maintenance therapy, and you'll probably stay on that, and hopefully you'll be in remission for a long, long time.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you, Janice, for calling. We're speaking. We're speaking to Dr. James Berenson from the Institute for Myeloma and Bone Cancer Research and Oncotherapeutics. One more short break, and we'll be back with more of your calls and emails.
You're listening to 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. Back to the program in just a moment. Film premieres, gala events, and celebrity guests create an aura of excitement around the 28th annual Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival, now through November 11th, funded in part by Broward Cultural Division. Details and tickets at fliff.com. We're funded by listeners like you and by the Miami Beach Antique Jewelry and Watch Show, Miami Beach Convention Center, October 25th to 27th, featuring 100 dealers. Something you've always wanted might just be here. Tickets at antiquejewelrymiami.com.
The Broward Center for the Performing Arts presents its 2013-2014 Classical Series. The season includes the Estonian National Symphony Orchestra, conducted by rising star Anu Tali, featuring cellist Nara Kokhnuzarian, the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra, Russia's St. Petersburg Philharmonic Orchestra, violinist Daniel Hope, and finally, pianist John Kimura Parker. Tickets and information at browardcenter.org. For many, a charitable bequest is a unique expression of appreciation. The thoughtfulness of many individual families, like the Levinsons and Fines, has led to planned gifts which help WLRN sustain and grow. Through your will or estate plan, you can name Friends of WLRN as the beneficiary of your estate or a portion of it, providing an enduring legacy of public media for years to come. To learn more about making an impact through planned gifts, call 305-350-7977.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, we're discussing multiple myeloma with one of its leading experts, Dr. James Berenson. He's joining us from Beverly Hills, California. You have an email, Bonnie?
Actually, we have two. One brief one Marie wants to know if a person from here can consult with you, Dr. Berenson.
Well, I think that you need to see me in L.A. I'm not a big believer of doing internet consults. I think people need to come and be seen in person. So I think it's a much more useful consult for the patient. But we do see patients from all over the world, but we do require the first visit to be here. Subsequently, some patients, in fact, I have a teleconference in a little while with a patient who's in the East Coast. So we do that as well. But the first visit, we like to see patients.
Okay, and another one from George. For someone in remission 9 months after a stem cell transplant, autologous transplant, are there clinical trials worth investigating to complement daily Revlimid?
Not at this point. In fact, that's the subject of a talk I have to give in New York this Thursday. But at this point, we don't really have trials beyond the fact that Revlimid looks like an effective post-transplant treatment among patients who've seen Revlimid up front. We certainly do have patients who now are staying on therapy long-term to maintain their remissions. We don't really in our group believe in drug holidays, but we do believe in giving patients therapy in which it doesn't impact their quality of life.
Let's take another call. This is Steve. Whoops. Let's go to Jaime in Miami. Jaime, you're up.
Hi, hello. This is a question for Dr. Berenson. My mother was diagnosed with multiple myeloma in 97 at the age of 47, and through the good work of her oncologist, she's actually been in remission for almost 15 years. And through a bone marrow transplant and chemotherapy and Zometa, which she currently came off of because it was impacting her jaw through necrosis. Now, my question is, she's recently been re-diagnosed with the disease as being active, although all her protein markers are correct. And they're saying that she has what's called a non-secretory myeloma. Could you explain something about that?
Yeah, I know quite a bit about that. I have a bunch of patients with that. Non-secretory means it's a myeloma that doesn't make that funny antibody protein. And that can happen long-term. The cell forgets to make the marker. We do have now another marker that we've developed in our own lab to follow patients like your mom called BCMA. It's a protein that falls off the myeloma cell, and you can measure it in the blood. So that may be a way that we could follow your mother and patients like her with non-secretory disease. Again, patients with non-secretory disease means you don't make the typical antibody that comes out of the malignant plasma cell, but you still have the myeloma. These patients, like your mother, very difficult to follow right now. That's why we think this new marker is going to be helpful, because you have to really basically follow them by how they're feeling, measure their blood counts, and measure their urine protein levels, and occasionally do things like PET scans to look at their bones. And unfortunately, bone marrows all too often, which I don't like to perform on patients because they hate having them done.
Before we run out of time, about contact information.
Well, the contact information, Dr. Berenson, is imbcr.org. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
And we'll have links on our Facebook page and also our website, wlrn.org.
And did you want to give a phone number also?
Sure. They can reach us at 310-623-1210. Or 1214.
Okay. I read a list of maybe 13 recent accomplishments that you're responsible for at IMBCR. If you could just tell us about a few of them, the recent successes, and if you could put them in lay terms for us, I would appreciate that.
Sure, absolutely. So I think in terms of the things we've tried to do at the Institute to bring myeloma patients better lives, we have identified this marker that's in the blood of myeloma patients called BCMA. We believe this protein also may explain the immune deficiency that both puts patients at higher risk to develop myeloma, as well as may prevent the immune system from getting rid of the myeloma, because we think this protein, when it's in the blood, doesn't allow the factors that normally drive your immune system to work so well. We have also been able to use a really old drug for myeloma from the 80s, believe it or not, interferon, which we could never give enough of patients, we could never get enough in patients without them feeling like they have the flu all the time. We figured out a way to target that so it only gets, if you will, dumped into the myeloma cell and leaves the rest of the body alone. So you can deliver 10,000-fold more of this into the myeloma cell than the rest of the body. It's a very exciting finding, and actually we are able to now eliminate the myeloma in animals. We're trying to do this with a number of other targeted antibodies that will bind the surface of the abnormal myeloma cell, and then along for the ride is the drug that you put on the top of it, and then that's released into the cancer cell, boom, eliminating the cancer, but not having untoward effects elsewhere because it's nowhere to be found but latched onto the myeloma cell. We've also identified a number of different treatments that are very, very novel for myeloma. Those have both come from the clinic and then back to the lab where we've been able to verify their effectiveness with drugs that you would not think would be very useful for myeloma as well. In addition, we've also identified a new factor called TRAF6, which both drives myeloma and myeloma bone loss, and we've now identified ways to block that factor, which can lead to better effectiveness of chemotherapy and also ability to eliminate the bone loss, which is the major problem in myeloma that patients experience clinically. So those are just a few tidbits of things we've done.
Quite a few tidbits you have there.
Yeah.
Well, I wish
it's
we had.
It's a very exciting time.
Yeah,
very
it
exciting.
Sounds it. I wish we had longer. We've been speaking with Dr. James Berenson. He's the CEO and Medical Scientific Director of the Institute for Myeloma and Bone Cancer Research, President and CEO of Oncotherapeutics, conducting clinical trials throughout the United States. Dr. Berenson, thanks so much for your time today, and we'll have a link to the imbcr.org at our website and our Facebook page.
Thank you, Bonnie. Thank you very much.
And that wraps up today's edition. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get to. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. More information, including links and discussions, at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program is with Georgetown University law professor Peter Edelman. He's written So Rich, So Poor, Why It's So Hard to End Poverty in America. And to the calendar, on this day in 1805, 208 years ago, British Admiral Horatio Nelson dies in the Battle of Trafalgar. It was the Royal Navy fighting the combined force of French and Spanish navies. Also on this day in 1879, 134 years ago, inventor Thomas Edison perfects the carbonized filament light bulb at Menlo Park. It burned for 13.5 hours. One more while we recall his bent trumpet and pouched cheeks. On this day, 1917, 96 years ago, the birth of jazz trumpet icon Dizzy Gillespie in Chera, South Carolina. In 1941, while playing with the Cab Calloway Band, an altercation ensued. Gillespie had to be restrained after pulling a switchblade on Calloway. Yo. We leave with this from Edison, whose inventions fueled the age of communications. They include a stock ticker, a mechanical vote recorder, a battery for an electric car, recorded music, and motion pictures. Quote, opportunity is missed by most people because it is dressed in overalls and looks like work. Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned to Public Radio. Next, it's Here and Now.